this past January. And that appointment recognized many years of distinguished leadership that he has provided in the field. When I say many years, despite his youth. He is the founder, president, and chief executive officer of Operation Hope, America's first nonprofit social investment banking organization. It is operating in some 51 communities in the United States and in South Africa. It has raised over $400 million to empower the poor. Mr. Brown's work has been recognized with over 400 honors, as diverse as Oprah Winfrey's Use Your Life Award, to being chosen for the program Global Public Policy and Leadership for the 21st Century at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government this past April. It is a real honor for me, and I think a very fortunate opportunity for all of us, to have such a dynamic individual to start the proceedings today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming John Brown.
Good morning. Good morning. I come to the podium out of respect, because that's what you do at a national conference like this. And now I'll move away from the podium. And so as not to scare you, I'll tell you in advance, I'll probably be walking off the stage also. This is an important conference. I want to commend SETI and the co-sponsors. In particular, SETI has done incredible work that really reminds me in many ways of the work that we try to do in the United States. One of the things that they've done around entrepreneurship and tying this financial literacy to real life issues, I think is particularly impressive and needs to be commended. Canada and the US, of course, share a lot of common history. And probably the only place in the world that does freedom better than the United States is Canada. And so my first challenge to you today, recommendation, request, is as you, Canada, has laid out a national health care policy and social welfare policy and other important policies in the 20th and 21st century, I think it's time for a national financial literacy policy and a national financial literacy focus, and would encourage you to take that up. But my recommendation to do that comes with some precedence. Let's first go to the practical. Every modern economy goes through four major stages. The agricultural age. By the way, I want to acknowledge my peers here, Dyer Duguay from Citi, who you'll hear from soon, who doesn't look like it, but she's several months pregnant. And I didn't want to get too personal. But now that you've opened the door, she's 7 months pregnant. Stand up, Dara. Stand up, stand up, stand up. You opened the door, stand up. Well, a pure class and style from Citi, and does an incredible job leading their global financial education efforts, and we're proud to be global partners with them in financial literacy. Mr. Pond from the UK has also set, I think, some important global standards. The UK is leading, in many ways, the world with some of their innovations, one of which is what I call the kids' accounts, where every child gets a bank account at birth with £250 in it, and what a powerful, aspirational way to make financial literacy real in people's lives, and what a great way to tie in entrepreneurship and other important messages. Back to the story. Every economy goes through four major stages. The agricultural age, the industrial age, the technology age, and the information age. America is in the information age. For the most part, so is Canada. So is the place that innovated the Industrial Revolution, the UK. I think it's interesting that in the technology age, but more so, let me, because that's actually a little bit opaque. In the industrial age, the issue was really civil rights. The industrial age required a push for civil rights, for a leveling of the institutional playing fields of access and opportunity for women, for minorities, for people who are different. In America, we had this campaign. Really, this campaign really was unfolding all over the world. This was, in many ways, this issue of civil rights, the campaign that Gandhi undertook in India. This issue of civil rights was, in many ways, a campaign that Nelson Mandela undertook in South Africa. Of course, I would cite Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement, or the second American Revolution, I call it, in the United States. It just so happens that my mentor, my role model, my personal hero, who I was just with yesterday, is Andrew Young, who was Dr. King's most trusted right arm, his most trusted aide. And as he and I, he's our global spokesman, and as he and I were in a classroom together with 200 young people in inner city Atlanta, Andrew Young said, "You know, we fought for civil rights, the access, the ability to access a hotel, as an example, to access his conference room, his conference center. But if Martin Luther King Jr. was alive today, we'd be fighting for civil rights." That was a slip. Did you hear the translation? I want to make sure that translated perfectly. From civil rights to silver rights. That the issue is no longer basic access to the hotel or the conference room. The question is not can you have access to the conference room, but to the hotel room, but can you afford to pay the hotel bill? Do you have the skills to one day have a dream made real or made possible of actually owning that hotel? A hand-up philosophy, not a hand-out philosophy. He went on to say that if Dr. King was alive today, this would be the work he'd be doing. This issue of poverty eradication and empowering people is the work that he believed Dr. King would be doing. And for those who this might sound a little remote, it might be helpful to understand that even in the movement of civil rights, embedded in that was a business philosophy. When Dr. King was marching in the South, oftentimes you didn't see Andrew Young in the photos marching with him. Where was Andrew Young? Dr. King would often, he called him Andy, he would often say to Andrew Young, I call him Ambassador Young, "Andy, I'm going to go get attention for this incredible, important issue." And while the media is paying attention to this civil rights stand, that's not going to change anything. I need for you to go meet with 100 business leaders in town while I'm marching. Because if you can get 100 business leaders in town to agree to anything, the politicians will ultimately come around. Why were 100 business leaders even interested in this discussion? Wasn't it a social justice issue? Wasn't it just a purely civil rights issue? Why would 100 business leaders be interested in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? Well, in the South, 80% of the customers of these businesses were black. And the business owners didn't care whether they came in the back door, the front door, or through the window, as long as they hit the cash register before they left. Paid, I meant. So even then, it was a business issue. Even then, it was a business issue. So in many ways, Andrew Young helped to set the agenda up, and Dr. King, of course, paid it off. So if civil rights was an era of race and the color line, and it hasn't gone away, but I think it has faded from the primary issue, then silver rights is the issue of class and poverty. Class and poverty. That is the issue that we face in the information age. A leading CEO told me the other day that we have retreated from discrimination around place and space access. Place and space, basic job opportunities, and so on and so forth. But we've desegregated place and space, but we've resegregated knowledge. That the new battleground in developed countries, in particular around the world, but oftentimes what separates developed and developing countries and even those cultures within a developed country is this issue of knowledge. So the first thing I want to say is I think you need a national strategy. The second thing I want to say is I think there's a historical precedent for this march, if you will, forward. And I see all of you as 21st century civil rights leaders. If civil rights was waged and won in the streets, civil rights would be waged and won in the suites, the corporate boardrooms, the conference rooms, the classrooms. It's knowledge-based. The education's going to be the ultimate poverty eradication tool, because when you know better, you tend to do better. Which leads me to the third step of my message today. This has got to move from what I call, well, there are two sort of families of financial literacy I found. The biggest family is we are the world, we are the future. It's very sweet, very nice, very not offensive. It's once a year, it's a financial literacy fair. It's a financial literacy day. Take your kid to financial literacy, whatever the thing is. It's very nice, it's very sweet. But that's not sustainable, and that's not, in my opinion, real. Financial literacy is a hard economic tool, an under-leveraged hard economic tool. The second camp are people and institutions like SETI and others, the organizers of this conference, who understand that financial literacy is a hard business issue and it is aspirational. And this is what's going to, I think, migrate your issue into the mainstream in Canada and around the world. I was meeting with Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke and four of the Fed governors about 4 weeks ago, and I challenged them to put an economist on this question. If 95% of Americans were financially literate, would American GDP increase by 1%? And while, of course, he could not answer the question in relative terms, he didn't disagree with the basic theory that if you increase financial literacy to the majority of the population, the probability that you increase GDP for your economy is very significant. And when your economy is a $14 trillion U.S. economy, the U.S., $14 trillion, 1% in GDP is extraordinarily significant. But also the question, if you had 95% of the population financially literate, would you have a subprime mortgage crisis as severe as what we've experienced? Would there be a floor to this crisis? I think the answer is yes, and they agree. So you'd have a floor on how bad it got. Well, by the way, this subprime crisis has migrated to a credit crisis, to a liquidity crisis, to a crisis of basic business and consumer confidence and has not only migrated but morphed across borders and is now spreading around the world. If America coughs, the rest of the world will get a cold in this global economy that we live in. And Canada is also a major economic driver. We share a lot in common. And if the UK and the US and Canada slows down, then China stops manufacturing goods and they slow down along with India. Are you with me so far? I'm sorry, I have low self-esteem. Are you with me so far? I'm from the black church. So I'm used to seek and respond. So I'm not gonna ask you to say amen, but occasionally I'll ask you to make sure that you have a pulse, that you're alive, and that you're still with me. The biggest thing that I have to say to you, and what really drove policy changes in the US, is not obvious. You'll need academic studies. You'll need rigor. You'll need economists to begin wrestling with this issue. You'll need a third conference. This will have to become an annual conference. The ministers of finance and other ministers will actually have to show up. Prime ministers will begin to rally around. All this stuff is important. But the thing that's going to get you real traction is what I call aspirational relevance. Let me break this down and be very specific. And then I'm going to go into my personal story and then wrap up. I always sort of chuckle when somebody says that I was appointed vice chairman of the U.S. President's Council on Financial. It's true, and I'm deeply honored by it. But it didn't quite happen that nice and neatly. Politics is not that nice and neat. I was in my mind wondering whether I was going to tell a joke that might not go over so well. That's what the pause was for. Well, I'll tell it anyway. When I was appointed, I grew up in a challenged neighborhood. I grew up in Compton, California, South Central LA. I'm very proud of it. And when I was appointed, some of my African-American friends were, oh, this is amazing. I said, look, you know how bad things are? When they put a brother in charge of money in times of crisis? In 2002, I hosted two U.S. presidents in 1 week. Because I don't believe that, and I was looking at TV last night and looking at all of the very passionate Canadian politicians. And I thought the U.S. was tough. I mean, at least we take the gloves off. I mean, you guys start with it off. That's the beauty of a democracy and beauty of freedom, and it's every good marriage to be made of constructive friction. And I was watching these politicians on television, and it hit me that the first thing I had to say to you is that this is not a partisan issue. Because when we hosted President Bush and President Clinton, in 1 week we hosted President Clinton in Harlem, our first black president, and that'll hit you later. Maybe that's just a U.S. thing. He's very cool and has a special affinity of African Americans, and we call him an honorary black man. Anyway, the second, that was actually pretty funny, but why it didn't hit you, I don't know. The second president we hosted was, of course, President George W. Bush. And immediately I got some of my friends, and by the way, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, I'm a capitalist with a heart. Some of my friends came to me and asked me why I was hosting, quote, this man. I said, well, first of all, he's a nice man. You get to know him, he's a nice man. You may not agree with all of his policies, and you may not even like him, but we've never had a president we liked. when he was in office, or hopefully she one of these days. We like them before they get in office, and we like them after they leave. So he's a nice guy. And I said, but beyond all that, he's the president. It's not like six of them. So whoever they are, we should have a relationship with them. And they went on pressing me about this issue. And I said, look, I don't care. My community is in a crisis. I don't care whether you're rich or poor, conservative or liberal, Republican or Democrat, black or white. If you want to help me eradicate poverty in my community, you are my friend. And if you don't, you're just wasting my time. PhDs are good, but PhDs are even better. So it's not about, and this is against the US analogy, it's not about the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, it's about the Get It Done Party. And I just want to get it done. So we hosted President Bush. It was a very important day, the 10th anniversary of the rebuilding of the after the riots in South Central LA, which was for us a market story. This is about billions of dollars going in an inner city community that had previously been burned down. No one did this because of social promotion. No one did this because it was a sweet thing to do. I mean, you may put a few pounds up. You may put a few thousand dollars up because it's a sweet thing to do. You don't invest billions of dollars because it's a sweet thing to do. You invest billions of dollars because it has a return on investment and makes good economic sense. And that's a story, hopefully, if I have a few minutes, I'll get into the economic viability of these communities we're talking about, which makes financial literacy actually relevant and gives it a self-sustainability. But that was sort of the message, the revitalization and the dignity of people wanting a hand up and a hand out. We hosted them, and then immediately thereafter, I got really idealistic. Oh, this is the President of the United States of America, came to South Central Los Angeles. He's now my friend. He has a special nickname for me. He has these nicknames. He calls me Johnny Boy, which I said is really great as long as you never forget the Johnny part. You guys are a hard audience. And so I started sending proposals to the White House. I mean, over and I mean, concept papers and referendums and resolutions. And they were always very nice to me, but it never got any traction. And I couldn't figure out why. And there's certain things I can say in this forum, and there's certain things I cannot. So I'm going to trust you to connect some of the dots here. So I'm going to have to now skip a part of this story and go toward the end. I ended up writing a letter to the President of the United States of America in April of last year that I thought might end our relationship professionally. He likes me, I like him, I like President Clinton. If you're president, you're not an unlikable person. You may not agree with him, but he's not an unlikable person. And so I wrote a letter that might end our personal relationship. And I basically said, the reason your domestic policies are not succeeding like you want them to is, with all due respect, you're not respecting the first civil right of the civil rights era. That the first civil right is financial literacy in this 21st century economy. Really. So I made the case. We have an increasing problem with subprime mortgages. You take predatory lending out of the game, you take speculation, you take fraud, you take investor overconfidence, and at the core of this, you have massive levels of payment shock. People who ask what was the payment and not what was the interest rate. You never ask what the payment is when there's an interest rate attached. We bought homes like people buy automobiles, by asking what's the payment. We bought automobiles like people purchase an iPod. And if you put an iPod, a MP3 player, on a credit card and make minimum payments, it'll cost you $4,000 over time. If you add six zeros to that and call it a 30-year fully amortized mortgage, you have an economic tsunami. And so I said, the reason you have this massive subprime crisis is that people are massively financially illiterate. Not poor people, by the way. This is a middle class crisis. Everybody in here probably knows somebody or has read a story of somebody you can relate to who is in the midst of this economic crisis. And by the way, after the mortgage issue, you're going to be dealing with a home equity loan issue, at least in North America. You'll be dealing with a credit card issue, potentially an auto loan issue, and in some places, a student loan issue. And if you're not paying your mortgage, you're probably not paying your car loan. You probably overextended on your credit cards. It's a slippery slope. Back to the story. So I made the case about mortgages. And then I made the case about Social Security reform. And I said the reason that you couldn't get traction on Social Security reform, everybody knows it needs to be reformed. But, and I know you've done some pension reforms here in Canada, but you can't ask, well, people who can't balance their checking account know they can't manage their Social Security account, but don't want to say it. Why? Shame. There are two taboos in this country, in this world, I'm sorry. This is universal. Sex and money. Nobody wants to talk about sex. Nobody wants to talk about money. We love both. But sex has come off the hook with this TV series and the movie called Sex in the City. I'm sure you've heard about this TV series and the movie. It's mainstream, this conversation, so that you can have the conversation without it being dirty, being perceived as dirty or pornographic. But money is still this sort of taboo. I don't know any, you have credit scores in Canada, yes? I don't know any woman with a who calls their girlfriend and says, girl, my credit score is 500, what's yours? So there's a taboo, there's a shame around this issue of money. And so people in the audience are shaking their head when the president talks about Social Security reform, but nobody is responding. The third thing I went to, oddly enough, was education. And I said, we have increased the test requirements. We've done this, we've done that. We still need a bit more funding. But we've done this, we've done that. But people are still dropping out of high school in America at a 30% rate. That is reason for, that is just alarming. A 30% dropout rate. But in the urban communities, it's 40 to 75%. I said that the reason these kids are dropping out of high school is they don't believe education is relevant to their future. How do you make education relevant to their future? Show these kids how to get rich legally. That's financial literacy, free enterprise and capitalism, ownership, civil rights, and entrepreneurship. If you have a public record, prison, probation, parole, you can't get a job in a major company because you cannot pass a background check in the short term, no matter how brilliant you may be. Let me say something in politic for a moment. If you have a public record, a prison record, if you were a drug dealer, it is unethical, it is immoral, and you need to pay your debt to society. But if you were successful at it, whatever successful means, if you were successful at it, you were not dumb. You understood import, export, finance, marketing, wholesale, retail, customer service, geography, territory, and profit margin. So you're not talking about dumb people, you're talking about misdirected people. Are you with me so far? Now put all this in a letter. My wife said, you'll never get another call from the White House. I got a call the next week. The call was, the president would like to see you. There'll be other people in the meeting, but it's the first time in the history of our country that a meeting for financial literacy will be held in the Roosevelt Room in the White House, and it's basically your agenda. So I went to the meeting, and we had all the secretaries of the Treasury, of Education, of HUD, basically all the people I called out in the meeting, their portfolios were represented in the Treasurer Audra Cabral. If you don't know her, she's fabulous. We're in this roundtable, about 40 cabinet members and staff. And they said, what do you want the government to do? And I said, I want a national agenda. But it wasn't my agenda. It was the president's agenda. It was the nation's agenda. It was speaking to a political moment made opportune. And so to fast forward, we were negotiating back and forth, and one day, the negotiations had frustrated me, and Andrew Young asked me, how were they going? And I, I said, I don't know, this may be just a, I was a, in a cynical moment, this may just be a photo op. He said, John, stop it. Don't be cynical. Be skeptical, but have hope. If he fails, we fail. If he succeeds, we succeed. Assume he's a good man who wants to do the right thing, who's been given bad counsel. Give him good counsel and wait for the political opportunity and then make your proposal. That conversation went from April of 07 to December of 07. I got a call in January of 08 saying the president would like to see you. He's going to sign an executive order making financial literacy the policy of the United States of America. He then created the U.S. President's Council on Financial Literacy, and to my surprise, well, not to my surprise, he made Charles Schwab, the billionaire chairman, who was a great choice. He is a brilliant man and a great chairman, and I'm honored to serve with him and for him. But to my surprise, he made me vice chairman. We serve into 2010, which means it is bipartisan. It will straddle two presidential administrations, which is a message I sent to you earlier. It's not a partisan issue, and I believe it's going to be a big part of his legacy. Now, let me switch into another gear for a moment. This is personal to me. I grew up in South Central LA in Compton, California. My mom and dad are amazing, brilliant people, but they divorced over money. The number one cause for divorce is money. And my mother came home to send my brother to college. And the reason that blacks and browns drop out of college in the numbers that they do is not academic, it's money, by the way. My mother wanted to send my dad, my brother, to college, first young man in our, first child in our family to go to college, he would have been. But when she went to the bank, the $4,000 US was gone. My dad had made it to the bank first. Now, we owned an apartment building, a cement contracting business, our own home, a gas station, and a nursery in 1970 in South Central Los Angeles, and my mom and dad had no more than an eighth grade education. In fact, my uncle, who had a fifth grade education, and it's not because, by the way, they want to be uneducated, in the South, when you're growing up in the southern states, oftentimes you had to leave education to go to the farm to help to contribute to household income, and so oftentimes, in their era, education was not stressed. So, but my uncle owns a quarter of East St. Louis today. My mom and dad, as I just told you, were entrepreneurs, even though they were not formally educated. So they clashed over money. My mom worked at McDonnell Douglas Aircraft, has worked there for 35 years, recently retired, now has bought and sold five homes, lives comfortably in Houston, Texas, and will tell you she wants a man, but she doesn't need a man. And if she gets a man, he's going to be a BMW, a black man working. You had no idea what you're going to get today, did you? So my mother has no self-esteem issue. My dad, an amazing man and an entrepreneur, and has met a payroll for 53 years in his business. I'm an entrepreneur today because I saw him meet a payroll out of the front door of our house of people of every race. People who worked for him were of every race. So it wasn't a racial issue. I saw him meet this payroll at the front door of my house. I was so proud. Then a mortgage broker in America, if you don't have a bank in the neighborhood, you have a mortgage broker, came to our house and sweet-talked my father, told my dad he could have more and spend less. My dad was a proud man, didn't want to admit he didn't understand money. So he asked this question, what's the payment? My dad signed documents he didn't understand, and we lost our home. Now, I didn't say we lost his home. We lost our home. Why? Because assets are passed down from generation to generation, and hopefully asset accumulation and wealth helps with wealth accumulation. We have the opposite effect here because now today, my wife and I actually had to build a four-unit apartment building on the foundation of the house that he lost. And we pay $4,000 a month, honored to do it, but how many children can afford to do this to subsidize my dad's dignified retirement because he can't afford to do it himself? 53 years working a job, but here's what I know. It's not about making more money, it's about making better decisions with the money you make. So if you make a dollar, but you spend $1.50, the more money you make, the broker you get. If you make a dollar, but you spend $1.50, the more money you make, the broker you get. So he lived 53 years, but he was financially illiterate and was afraid to tell anybody he didn't understand money. So I do what I do today because it's personal to me. So I founded Operation Hope after the riots of 1992 as America's first nonprofit social investment bank. And to which people said, nonprofit social investment bank. That's an oxymoron, and John, you're a moron. They said it would never work. I was 26 years of age. I was not part of the established leadership in my community, and everybody wrote me off. We had a $61,000 budget, one employee, and a vision to change the world and to eradicate poverty. I had been a successful businessman and had some money of my own, and I put up my own money because nobody would believe in it myself. To make a long story short, we have now raised just under $500 million U.S. from the private sector, not the government, to empower the poor. Our partners are 400 of the largest financial institutions in the world: Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, ING, you name it. It is easier to tell you who's not a partner than to tell you who is. We have 2,000 nonprofit and community partners because you've got to actually reach, teach. I know that SETI has about 800 partners you have worked with that I heard about. That's the right approach. We have about 2,000 nonprofit partners so you can actually reach your customer where they are and lift them up. And we're in about 1,500 low-wealth schools. And then we have about 100 government partners from local to state and regional and federal of, again, every political stripe. And it is a three-leg stool of government, community, and partnership working in collaboration because no one can eradicate poverty by themselves. Why does that work? Because government sets the rules of the game and provides safe streets and structure a national policy and wants the tax revenue. And the private sector wants to, well, they want an emerging market. Now, what I mentioned earlier, I sort of glazed over that this is not a charity issue. And let me give you a couple quick statistics. The economy for China is $2 to $3 trillion. The economy for blacks and Hispanics alone in America is $2 trillion. The alternative financial services sector in America is $8 billion. What's another $8 billion category? Mergers and acquisition fees on Wall Street. Blacks are about 10% of the U.S. population in America, but we purchase 25% of every movie ticket sold in America. We go to the movies once, we go to the movies twice, we rent the video, we copy it. You guys are a tough audience. I'm kidding, you actually are a good audience, I'm just messing with you. These communities are emerging markets. Now, in America, we call them inner cities. But in a place called, in France, you call it Paris. this is a very interesting point now. In America, the poor people live in the inner city, which is strategically located real estate. Somebody's going to finally figure that out. It's next to ports and airports and downtowns, and people are tired of driving an hour to get home, and the gas prices are higher, and so you're going to see these communities reclaimed. Anybody familiar with Harlem? One person. Okay, Harlem is Upper Manhattan. It's not a black community, it's Upper Manhattan, and it's an island. So after a while, with increasing wealth and increasing population and finite land, after a while, mainstream folks say minority folks are not so bad. Now you're seeing 1.5 million dollar townhomes in Harlem on 125th Street today. A teardown in Harlem is $750,000. Rent in Harlem for 5,000 square feet today is $50,000 a month. That's $750,000 a year, and you don't own it. And so when my friends read black, when my friends come to me and say, look what's going on in Harlem, we built a Hope Center in Harlem, look what's going on in Harlem, this is racism. I say, no, that's not racism, that's capitalism. And you need to go get you some. And the only problem with capitalism and free enterprise is you don't have any. And so what's keeping them from owning? Financial illiteracy. When you don't know better, you don't know. When you don't know better, you cannot do better. There's not a welfare mother in America that doesn't want her child to grow up to be successful, intelligent, hardworking, and taxpaying, if for no other reason than to feel proud of them. But you can't give what you don't have. In a blind town, a one-eyed man's king. If you don't know better, you cannot do better. You're not talking about dumb people. You're talking about people who just don't understand the rules of free enterprise and capitalism. What's your mission? Your mission is civil rights, to make free enterprise and capitalism relevant to the poor, to make free enterprise and capitalism work for the poor. And when you do that, you'll create an emerging market in Canada and more taxes for the Canadian government. In California, we have a $15 billion deficit this year. That's lost sales tax, lost property tax revenue. That's all massive financial illiteracy. Because they couldn't make the payment, because they had payment shock, they lost their home, and California has a $15 billion sucking sound right now, and it is the fifth largest economy in the world. So that won't happen for very long, because we can't afford for that to happen very long. So you're gonna see a reinvestment in real estate and by cities and states and counties throughout the US. So affordability of real estate is going to actually come back for the first time in probably a decade. So rainbows after storms. This issue of financial literacy would never have the resonance it has today if it wasn't for the crisis called the subprime mortgage crisis and the credit crisis. So a problem first creates an opportunity later. The question is, what are you going to do about it? Back to Operation Hope. Four divisions. Have a couple more minutes? Am I boring you? Couple more minutes? Operation Hope, banking on our future. We've taught 311,000 children checking, savings, credit, investment, and the history of banking, and a course in dignity. Why dignity? Because there's a difference between being broke and being poor. Being broke is economic, but being poor is a disabling frame of mind and a depressed condition of your spirit, and you must vow never, ever, ever to be poor again. If you want to put a child to sleep, tell them you're going to give them a financial literacy course. These kids, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, ooh, I can't wait to get a high interest rate mortgage. Nobody wants a mortgage, they want to become a homeowner. Nobody wants a car loan, they want an efficient automobile. I don't know anyone who just want an education for education's sake, unless you're an academic. You want what education can offer you. It's aspirational. You've got to connect this work with the hopes, desires, aspirations, and dreams of everyday Americans. We've called for a bank account in America for every person, because there's more people in America that don't have a bank account that didn't have the right to vote in 1963. And if not having the right to vote called for the civil rights movement, and not having a bank account in an economy, in a culture, in a democracy rooted in capitalism and free enterprise has to call for a civil rights movement. And that's why I like what the UK has done by tying financial literacy to aspiration with a young person at an early age and giving them a bank account. But more importantly, we put a role model in that classroom, because after an hour listening to this wonderful young lady give a course in financial literacy and dignity and entrepreneurship, the young girl in the third row who's never seen a woman with a business suit on is saying, I can be you. And that's how you break the back of poverty. The second thing we did is built Hope Centers. A Hope Center is a cross between a bank branch and a Kinko's for economic empowerment. It's one-stop shopping for changing your life, converting check cashing customers into banking customers, renters into homeowners, small business dreamers into small business owners, minimum wage workers into living wage workers with new job skills, moving people up and out of poverty and increasing the tax base in that community and giving them dignity. We are the first nonprofit in history to build a bank branch and sell it to a bank. We have 9 of them now around the country, and we don't want to be in the business. We want to do it for 5 years, and we want a bank to purchase us. Why are they buying us? Not out of charity. We have 13,000 customers a month coming through one location with 5,000 square feet in South Central LA, creating a market dimension and income for that bank, and they want that new market, emerging market opportunity. The third thing that we do is Hope Coalition America, which is sort of an economic Red Cross, and so we've helped people with Hurricane Katrina who had car loans but no cars anymore, home loans but no homes anymore, small businesses with no small businesses anymore. And we helped 112,000 people through Hurricane Katrina to negotiate with their lenders a positive resolution. And then our work that we do outside of the US. Let me wrap up just by saying that this is just the beginning for me of this work. I have launched and called for a new movement called 5 Million Kids. My strategy to break the back of the dropout generation in America. I want to educate 5 million kids in financial literacy. I want to give them a bank account. I want to get a mentor and a role model in front of every one of them. The book, The Tipping Point, says that you can get the 5% role models in any community, anywhere in the world, it stabilizes. This should give you hope. I mentioned Paris earlier. Let me go to that for a second. In Paris, well, in the suburbs of Paris, you have the poor. There was a riot twice recently. They call it Islamic extremism. Wrong. These are people who basically only feel that they're French when they pay their taxes. And they don't see themselves in French society. They don't see themselves in business. They don't see themselves in government. They don't see themselves in high society. So they figure, why should I go to school? Why should I work hard? Why should I stop at red lights? It's not going to pay off for me. And they don't see any opportunity for themselves. And so I'm not saying it's right, it's wrong, but they rioted. And what I think that they need is a civil rights mechanism. They need to buy people off with opportunity. I don't mean buy off literally. I mean figuratively. You got to distract people with a positive agenda for their lives and give them the tools. Everybody wants to live what we call in America the American dream. Everybody wants to live the Canadian dream or the French dream or wherever you happen to be from. So I guess what I'm saying is you thought you were just coming to a conference on financial literacy. But what I think the organizers realize is that this is the battleground. This is the baseline for a new movement. You cannot have an economy that's 80% dependent on consumers when the consumers are financially illiterate and expect to thrive. And we have in America the largest economy in the world, and no one's teaching our children checking, savings, credit, investment, and the history of banking. So this is, I mean, this makes sense. I don't care what way you come at it, but I am just, I came here because I'm inspired by the Canadian model, the Canadian entrepreneurship, the Canadian sense of possibility. I mean, you guys have universal health care. We don't have that in the United States. There are a lot of things you can do here that we and others seem to not have been able to get our hands around. I think that this is an area that you can also provide leadership in the world at, and I believe that it is something that is a historic moment in time. So let's say that nothing I've said to you as I go to my seat, nothing I said to you has touched you in any way. You were underwhelmed, and you really wish I'd sit down. And I wish I'd sit down too, so I'm going to. I'd say this. You don't get any credit for being a nice person. You don't get any credit for being pleasant to your neighbors or feeding your children or putting food on the table. You're supposed to do those things. The comedian, the prophet Chris Rock in America, he said one day, a guy walked up to him and said, "Man, I ain't never been to jail." He said, "You're not supposed to go to jail." The guy wanted credit for not going to jail. What kind of screwy mess is that? It is an entitlement mentality. It's not just of the poor. It's of the rich. It's of the wealthy. It is everywhere. We've got to stop figuring out what we're against and start figuring out what we're for. And so you don't get any credit for helping your neighbor or putting food on the table or doing. You're supposed to do those things. You only get credit for helping other people. And I don't know about you, but I want a spiritual platinum card with no limit on it. Thank you very much. God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.